The German civil service rang me up and he said, look, all of our models for the future have crashed. Doge is exposing a colossal amount of corruption that's been inherent in all systems around the world. How is it that someone like me can go and present at the United Nations conference on resources and say this stuff, right, and not get thrown out of the building?
It sounds, to be honest, a little bit too good to be true.
Well, let me tell you the bad news. Bad news is this.
If you end up in a situation where you've got New York, Chicago, L.A., San Francisco, they've got a bunch of these reactors powering them, and then they get bombed, what happens?
So if Luigi Bin Laden...
Welcome back to Radius of Reason, a podcast where we talk about the greatest problems facing humanity. My name is Andre, and I'm joined by my co-host, Levon.
This is another episode with Dr. Simon Michaud, building on our previous conversation about the limitations of the green transition, to discuss his proposed solution.
Dr. Michaud calls these proposed solutions to the green energy transition the purple transition. But we don't just talk about that. We get into Dr. Michaud's views on government inefficiency, Doge, geopolitics, and some other topics.
What we call the circular economy has to evolve into something else. Where do we get our resources from and what do we do with them? So I call this the resource balanced economy. This was evolved from Jacques Fresco's resource based economy. He's done some remarkable work there. So all these ideas have been developed on someone else. One of the foundation pieces is we make electricity and industrial heat using generation 4 thorium fueled molten salt reactors. And I've mapped these out in full and have also gone down the rabbit hole in terms of how they work and what they do. Electric vehicles we will still need, but instead of having lithium-ion chemistry, we do look at other chemistries like sodium or fluoride. Okay, now we're getting interesting. For our industry, we need high-end heat, like 2,000 degrees Celsius for things like smelting and making cement and all that. But if we knock out coal... if we substitute it with iron powder as a thermal fuel. Now, what's interesting is that iron fuel powder doesn't get destroyed when it's burnt. It transforms into rust, iron oxide. So if you took human sewage, which is a problem we've got to fix, deal with, put it into a pyrolysis plant, right? We turn that into syngas. That syngas could be used to strip the oxygen out of rust and turn it back to pure iron powder, or sponge iron, actually. And so you've got like a link between a waste product of a human society and recycling of an industrial fuel. For the long-range transport between continents, you know, like maritime shipping and freight, intercity freight trains, ammonia looks like, even though it's very inefficient and has its problems, is probably the logistically most sensible fuel to look at. And yeah, so that's your basic.
When you present this to people in government, what's their reaction? And also on top of that, if this is so obvious at this point that you've mapped this all out, and it's actually genuinely like a promising thing, why aren't the markets responding to it by investing, you know, directing all the investment toward that? Set of solutions.
There's a few problems here, and this is human nature as well. First problem is there's an incumbent system. There's an incumbent way of doing things at the moment. What I'm showing you there basically means all the existing system, most of it won't be necessary. And so a lot of people have then been told that a lot of what we've established already is not necessary and we've got to rebrand. And what we get on the other side is maybe not as easy to get, it won't be as convenient. And then they say, yeah, we don't like change at that level. That's like a full-scale metamorphosis, what's being proposed there. So what I'm now suggesting is we do things in small stages and see how we go. The problem with thorium in particular, iron fuel is not necessary while we've got coal. And while we've got coal, why will we bother? And while we're talking about, we should phase out fossil fuels. Yeah, that's nice. We're just going to keep using coal. But now when most of the coal happens to be in Chinese hands, either on their own territory or they own it directly, like a lot of the coal in Australia is already spoken for, especially all the good stuff, the high calorific stuff, and their concepts that most people I've come across don't know and don't want to know.
Hey guys, hope you're enjoying the show. Just a quick reminder to like and subscribe.
And drop us a comment. Let us know what you think about this episode.
The problem with thorium directly, though, has another problem. In 1972, a report was written by the Oak Ridge Nuclear Laboratory showing that this stuff worked. Thorium worked. And their test reactor passed all the tests, and now they want permission to build a full-size reactor. And it was presented to Richard Nixon. And at the time, we didn't have an energy crisis. We didn't have an environmental crisis. We didn't have a mineral shortage. What we had was the Cold War, and remember, early 70s. And the military, the U.S. military in particular, were calling the shots. And what they wanted was a civilian uranium-fueled nuclear system to camouflage the production of nuclear weapons. If they decided to go thorium, that whole uranium system would shut down and the production of nuclear weapons would be terribly exposed. The other problem was, if we go thorium, then a lot of the footprint of thorium, when you actually look at the calculations and everything, both the front end and the back end of the fuel cycle is orders of magnitude smaller and simpler, which means the people who are making a lot of money out of uranium, all of their stuff would be gone, like you wouldn't need it anymore, and its replacement would be many, many times smaller, so a lot of people would just have to eat the losses and go into something else. And they said, well, let's do uranium. There's no reason not to do it. We can make a lot of money. And at the time, Richard Nixon wanted jobs for California. And uranium, well, it's politics. It's human nature. And so a uranium system would mean lots of complex industries which would make a lot of money and employ a lot of highly educated people. And that was far more important, especially when they had plenty of oil still. You know, like, come on, man, what's the problem? And so the decision was made. Thorium had to go. And since then, there has been facing headwinds. And when you actually look at the documentation of the World Nuclear Association, I found the language of gaslighting. Yeah, like, let's say we're on a review panel. We're professors on a review panel, and we're reviewing students who are coming before us to present a PhD or a master's student work, which they do every year. And every now and then you get a student that tries to bullshit you. Yes, we haven't done any work, but look at the shiny ball. Look at this impressive-looking graph, but don't look at the numbers. Please let me live and sign the form. They use the language of gaslighting. I saw that language in some of the World Nuclear Association documents. What they would do is they would talk about thorium solid fuel. So the difference here is solid fuel versus liquid fuel, and solid fuel is indeed not very efficient. You wouldn't bother with thorium, you'd go back to uranium. But all discussions of liquid fuel were carefully directed back to solid fuel without actually answering any of the questions. They haven't actually done the work the work's been done by the Oak Ridge Nuclear, and I've got some of their reports. But in the World Nuclear Association reports, they don't report on liquid fuel fission metrics. So it just hasn't been done. And it's money. And so it's making a case now. The BRICS economies have been quietly looking at this for a while. While the West is saying, nope, la, 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 don't want to know, India has been testing solid fuel thorium, which I believe is cover for other operations. But China says, yeah, screw you, we're not going to hide this. And since in 2022, they've had a small 2-megawatt system running in the Gobi Desert of a liquid fuel system. And I've got a nice photograph of it. And they've recently, from then, they've had about like, I think it's 4 or 5 systems that run in parallel with different, slightly different technologies. And the way the Chinese do this is they don't put their hat on one technology. Their system is so large that they can back all technologies. And all technologies were given something the equivalent of, say, several hundred million dollars or euros or whatever, you know, like a lot of money. I said, all right, guys, you got some money? Let's see what you can do. And everyone, solar panels, wind turbines, hydro, geothermal, they're all out the gates and running. They're giving it their all. And everyone is watching to see how it goes. And thorium molten salt is one of them.
What do they do with the byproduct? Because it's still fissile material that's produced as a consequence.
Hang on, you mean about the waste that comes out of
the waste? Yeah.
Right. So when you put a solid fuel rod assembly into a conventional light water reactor, to run the reaction, you need the isotope of uranium-235. Now, naturally, U-235 is about 0.7% of uranium in yellow cake form, and it's got to be what's called enriched. They put it in this centrifuge to enrich the amount of U-235, and it gets up to about 4%, between 3% and 5%, depending on what year we're talking. All right. So around 4%. So they put that rod into the reactor. That 4% gets used up, sometimes less. And then when all it's gone, then it's not useful. The rest of it's uranium-238, and that's not useful. So they take the rod out and they said, right, now it's got to go into storage. 96% of the fuel that comes into waste is really, really, really problematic. Mm-hmm. And they've got to store it for long periods of time. Some of it, only some, has to be stored for the half-life goes for about 10,000 years, but they store it for 100,000. Right, but that's not all of it. That's only some of it. And then some of it they store, for a couple of hundred years. Thorium, though, is a liquid fuel system. The liquid fuel system can use thorium or uranium or, get this, spent nuclear fuel.
Interesting.
Right, in the right circumstances. And the reason it can do that is a liquid system, everything moves against everything else. There's no shielding. It's in a solid system, the stuff on the outside shields the stuff on the inside. But a liquid fuel, it doesn't matter if you've got something in there that takes a long time to transmute. So 96%, 96.1% of the fuel gets consumed, or gets used, rather. And 3.1% of the fuel is radioactive at the end. So we've got a massive step change down of the amount of waste coming out of these things. And then you've got the thing is the nature of the waste. The isotopes that come out of the thorium / uranium system, but let's say thorium. Thorium gets transmuted to uranium in the reactor. Uranium gets transmuted into fissile uranium in the reactor. So that's why it doesn't matter what you put in, you get the same coming out. The stuff that comes out is of isotopes that are mostly you store for 300 years, right? And to run this system, you've got the complexity of an isotope lab in a medical hospital.
Interesting.
Right. Now, you store the stuff for 300 years. About half of those isotopes by mass can be recycled into the isotope industry for the medical industry, medical isotopes. So some of the fuel can be repurposed if you could be bothered, but the amount of fuel is now much smaller. Now, nation state of Finland would need the equivalent of one truckload of salt fuel going in, and it would produce 120 kilograms of waste a year. 120 kilograms for the nation state of Finland for the whole year. So, wow.
It sounds, to be honest, a little bit too good to be true.
Well, let me tell you the bad news. Bad news is this.
Hey, everybody. We hope you're enjoying the conversation with Dr. Michaud. If you want to support this channel, please be sure to give this video a like and subscribe.
And of course, drop a comment and let us know what you think.
You've now got to fight the military-industrial complex and take away their money. Feel better?
A little bit. So, I mean, is that...
Andre has to do that?
Yeah, personally. Yeah. Skinny arms over here.
Skinny arms. So the Chinese are actually doing it.
Nature of the Chinese doing something, then the Americans should be freaking out doing it as well. But
my understanding is they are.
Interesting.
There's about 12 operators around the world, Rolls-Royce in the UK, for example. They're all quietly building this on the side. When you talk to these guys, they're all convinced they're going to be the next Rockefeller. They're going to be rich, the next oil baron. And since they're sitting on like a dynasty-based fortune, they're not going to talk to anyone else. And so everyone in the thorium industry is trying to knife everyone else, thinking they're going to get rich. But in reality, what happens is rich people come in and take all this stuff and they get cut out, and that's what happens. My understanding is the Department of Homeland Security in the United States was quietly looking at this, and they were in the advanced stages of having a reactor up and running. So you've got to build the reactor, then you've got to, you know, build it up to speed and get it up and running, and then they're operational. And so multiple countries around the world have got an energy source. That's why I think everyone is so goddamn sanguine about the problems that are coming up with renewable tech. Like, it's known and understood that they're not economically viable. Like in Denmark, the writing's on the wall. In the UK, the writing's on the wall. My understanding of the Department of Energy they understand this now. And so
do you have insight? I mean, you mentioned the kind of the proverbial Doge presence.
Yep.
In the past.
Okay. Too. Yes. Okay. I think I had to finish there. So Doge is exposing a colossal amount of corruption that's been inherent in all systems around the world. I believe not only every Western nation, but also every Eastern nation has these essential same problems.
What is the prospect? I guess I brought up Doge again because it's the question of developing these forms of or investing into these types of reactors when you have an administration that is hell-bent on returning fossil fuel production to the U.S.
Well, yeah, so you've got some headwinds there. So not only you've got like Trump doing the drill baby drill, what could possibly go wrong? Then you've got Emperor Musk. I actually I admire what Elon Musk is doing, but I can see why people want to arrange his downfall. He is backing a electric vehicle company, like lithium-ion-based EVs are his future, or so to speak. So the idea of a new technology that could come along and disrupt stuff, I suppose what we're talking about here is the energy generation side of things, not the electric vehicle production. But yeah, there are multiple headwinds there. What I think will happen, though, is reality will intrude itself savagely, where all around the world, all of the conventional systems, both the ones we've been using for a while and the ones we think we're going to use, are going to hit problematic bottlenecks. Meanwhile, China, our adversary, is quietly powering along. Right. And so that's what I'm saying is we're going to go into ideas will crash. New ideas will come in. There'll be like this constant treadmill. Let's try new stuff.
In other words, you're saying we're not going to overcome the political obstacles. It's just going to be by necessity. We're going to be forced to adopt these alternative solutions.
The political problems are eating each other on other fronts. Like the problems they've got at the moment is, you know, how do we deal with the fraud? I'm of the opinion what we're seeing is the tip of the iceberg and things are increasingly darker. We're seeing the simple stuff now, right? And I think they're going to roll out more and more problematic things as they sort of go along. Energy is very far away from any of that. Politics will eat itself, and reality will then come in, and Joe Sixpack will go, fix it. I don't care how you do it. And they say, well, this won't work. And why is that still working over in China? Well, okay. And I think this is known, and they're game theorying this. And then they'll roll out the solution when certain incumbent interest groups will allow it to happen because their normal way of doing things isn't working so well.
So eventually, the military-industrial complex, as which you identified as like the principal obstacle to this silver bullet, if you will, is going to realize that, yeah.
I think those fucking shower of assholes have been sitting on technology for some time that we could use.
Yeah, the alien stuff that they've been harvesting. Well,
Nikola Tesla, what was he doing? Did it work?
We don't know. Whatever was going on in New Jersey, wherever his like massive tower was, right?
So when I did my tour through the energy systems, I came up about like 40 or 50 different projects that revolved around the idea of that Nikola Tesla made famous, right, and everything. And my science director said, all right, you will now take a cold shower. This is not geology. Take it out. Yeah, this is all speculation. Yeah, and it says, right, so I'm now actually writing a book for me personally. And so once the Hawaii report comes out, thorium's now documented. And that frontier can then start up. But the final frontier is what I call the new electric. I'm writing a book called The New Electric, which looks at the fundamental paradigm shift behind what is energy and our understanding of it and how do we harvest it. And there's things like zero-point energy and electrogravitic systems. It's just a fundamentally different way of looking at stuff. And when you do look at it, it is weird. And one of the things I looked at was, what was Nikola Tesla doing and how did it work? Now, I can't replicate it, but I think I understand what he was doing and how we might use it if it worked, followed by, should we do it? And the answer is no. The problem with Tesla, he was transmitting electricity from one side of the planet to the other and back again, which means, and he had a big power generation at Niagara Falls. You know, hydropower, and so much electricity was being generated that we're never going to need this amount of electricity. And so we just transmit it all over the world. Anyone with an aerial can access this electricity. And as they don't pay any money for that, because it's just an aerial and it's just there, they use the term free. So it was economically free. And as long as the hydro plants at Niagara Falls was running, everyone had access to electricity. And so you could have, for example, a ship running an electrical propulsion system. So instead of like a diesel fuel tank or a battery bank, you just have an aerial. And you're downloading electrical power like we download information off Wi-Fi. Now, the question is, should we do this? Now, electronic smog, it's all about what frequency is involved. And a lot of the 5G technology out there happens to impact human health and the health of living things. So if we've got industrial levels of electricity now flowing through the air, but it has the capacity to impact living things, should we do it?
Hold on. Elaborate on that a little bit, the 5G health impacts.
Oh, okay. So there was a all right. So there was some of the work that I actually did with the Venus Project. I actually went down the rabbit hole and... Okay, where are we? Nope. Just bear with me while I find this. This is actually worthwhile. Okay. Holistic health technology impact. I haven't actually shown this to anyone else. Okay. So... All right. I've got some data to show you. When electricity was first invented and brought on in large scale, certain health problems started to increase. And some of this stuff's a little surprising. So I'm still chasing it down. Like, I still don't quite understand what this is. Okay. So in 2019, this is what people died from. Heart disease and cancer and was most of it. So there was an increase in cancer, an uptick in the 1950s. What happened? So we're going along, and suddenly 1950s, everything took off. So we started producing plastics around then, so that's one problem. Toxic chemicals. Hang on, let me get past this. This is all the chemical stuff. Forever chemicals. Yeah. Okay, all right. Okay, electronic smog. Pollution caused by electric and magnetic fields generated by power lines in particular. And these are the frequencies they operate at. And so there's a graph to show you. Where is it? Health effects. Okay, so the health effects that have been documented at the moment. This is actually what I think...
Sorry, Simon, documented by who?
Okay. There is a series of health medical papers in the literature that document this stuff, but RFK Jr. is now one of the things he's actually talking about, taking the health department to task? Is this one of the things he's looking at? All of this stuff is in the literature.
Hold on, which literature? Because like, is it published?
Published in, peer-reviewed medical paper.
Like in the Lancet or something less reputable? Like, I mean, it's
all of the above.
I mean,
all of the above. There's some stuff in the Lancet, but there's also some stuff out there. This is actually not my technical field, right? So I've got a layperson's look at this, but there are published papers that show this, that are peer-reviewed. Okay, here's where we're going. So diabetes. So sugar consumption in the United States from 1820 just went up and up and up, and it plateaued around 1920. Then around 1960, it started going up again. And that's when we started using corn sweeteners.
Mm-hmm.
Right, and so our prevalence of diabetes in the United States is here. So that window there is that window there. So the prevalence of diabetes has gone through the roof here. And so in 1993, the internet started to take off. And so technology and Wi-Fi and stuff started to actually sort of come in. And so the question was posed, is diabetes an electric disease? Now, remember, I'm not a medical doctor. And so these are patterns I've found. But this was another interesting one I found in an old paper. Influenza deaths per million in England and Wales, 1850 to 1940. In 1890, we had a spike. Why? And so in 1888, Westinghouse Electric acquired AC current technology. And 1890 is the start of the modern electrical era, which happens to be right there. Now, this is just a correlation. I have no explanation. Is one actually related to another? But this is the idea that we should actually look at this. So you've got plants growing under a Wi-Fi router versus plants not growing under a Wi-Fi router. This was a couple of students in Denmark. Right. So, yeah, anyway, you get the idea.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if we're really qualified to assess that.
Neither
are you to present that. But, I mean, look, I'm all for people studying these things. I wouldn't be surprised if there are certain effects in the ether that we're not aware of, you know, like it's entirely possible. But I do want to make sure we kind of...
All care and responsibility. I'm not a doctor. I'm not a medical doctor. What I did was I found... while going down the idea of what would happen if we put industrial level power, electrical power, into the air to be downloaded in the form of electronic smog, then I went down the rabbit hole of, well, is electronic smog a problem now? And there are certain things that are signatures out there that are documented in peer-reviewed medical papers that show that there is a signature. Now, what I'm sort of saying is we should look at this.
I'm definitely open to people looking at that. I guess, you know, this is kind of related to the whole meta crisis framing of things, where a lot of the solutions that we come up with have unintended consequences, right. And that we've got to now produce new solutions and so on. So let's think about the purple transition from this angle. What do you think are some of the unintended consequences from the use of, you know, the kind of four different technologies that you proposed? And what might we have to deal with as a result?
We're talking about a complete decentralization of everything. And in fact, it's actually possible that the human system could contract in size while maintaining capability. And that was an interesting outcome. But some of the things like let's take all the sewage and we're going to turn it into a pyrolysis plant. We know how to do that. That's mature technology, but can we do it at scale? Unknown. That's asking to have a series of health emergencies while we're working at how to do it at scale. So all technology that when it comes online, there's a series of industrial accidents, no exceptions. Like when we first started using steam, when we first started using internal combustion engines, when we started using electricity, is we had a series of things that we had to learn the hard way. And a lot of it was like tragedies that we now look back on and say, of course you wouldn't do that. And this could be one of those things. The other consequence is the idea of having nuclear reactors so close to civilian populations is something that, most people are not comfortable with. Now, in Hawaii, for example, it's in the legislation that they're not allowed to use nuclear of any kind.
Including thorium.
Thorium is considered not a mature technology. It's not accepted, because they've been told it's not accepted.
But by the United States?
By the World Nuclear Association.
Okay, interesting.
You know, that's what I'm saying, it's the incumbent. Trust us. But then someone pointed out that floating in the Hawaiian harbor are multiple ships with sometimes 3 and 4 nuclear reactors on each. Like a reactor, a modern aircraft carrier mm-hmm. has 8 nuclear reactors on board.
Mm-hmm.
8. One's not enough. And so they've got floating in the harbor right next to the civilian population, and that's been there for years. So they know how to do it. But if you start having a situation where every town has one of these, like the size of the system is small. It's like the size of a shipping container. So you've got the reactor and then you've got the turbine next to it, which is about the same size. So 2 shipping containers in size. But if you've got one in every town and that's their power, and you have a Homer Simpson moment. Now, these technologies are supposed to be walk-away safe. They've gone to quite an extraordinary level to make them safe. But humans are humans, and they do dumb shit. And I'm sure we'll find a way to cause a problem.
If there was like a spree of bombings, you know, of these kind of reactors, like what are the implications of that?
Okay.
So like if you end up in a situation where you've got New York, Chicago, LA, San Francisco, they've got a bunch of these reactors powering them. And then they get bombed. What happens?
So if Luigi Bin Laden had an Allah Akbar moment, and they went around, they blew up all the reactors, what would happen? So these systems are liquid. You put the salt in, and then you put the neutron thing to actually sort of get it going, and the fuel gets turned into an isotope uranium, and it goes around, and it's a liquid. It's already liquid, and as such, it can't melt down. Let's say, you know, Allah Akbar, boom, it blows up.
No, keep going.
So you've got now the contents of the reactor are now all over the floor. You've got a liquid fuel. When the reactor gets to a certain temperature, it cascades over the top of itself, called Doppler broadening, and the reaction shuts down. If it gets past a certain temperature, the fuel leaks out of the reactor into tanks. But if someone's to blow it up, you've now got hot salt, which will then cool, in liquid form, all over the floor. Right, and so it will be emitting radiation as a consequence of this. So someone will have to go in and clean it up. But it'll be a local thing. It's not going to spread like an aerosol all over the place. Someone said, "Can you make a nuclear device out of uranium-233?" You can, but it's not a very good one. You're better off starting with uranium-238 and making fissile uranium out of that. And so, boom, it goes all over the floor. You then call up a cleanup crew, and until then, it just emits radiation, and you've got an industrial disaster. It's smaller. If someone takes, for example, a gas refinery, right, and nobody smokes, someone smokes, boom, and then you've got like a fire, that's actually a larger footprint than what we're talking about here, and the toxic chemicals that would then go in the atmosphere. And so it is smaller in size, right, but it's a different kind of problem, right? You know, you've got the material is liquid until it cools into a solid form again. So it's not going to spread everywhere, but radiation will come off it, which will penetrate, you know, the local building. So you'll have like a localized area of radiation exposure.
Okay. And then it seems manageable then, based on what you're saying. Okay.
What I'm getting at here is humanity at large has to become more mature And across, this is actually across the board, what we were talking about before. We've got to step up, and the average person has got to be more aware and take more part in more of the value chain of their life. At the moment, I go into a local supermarket and I wave a bit of plastic at something and they give me this bag of groceries and I don't even have to talk to anyone.
Yeah. No, we definitely agree with that. No, it's
right.
There's a huge disconnect. What about some of the other things that you mentioned? So iron powder as a fuel source for like high temperature manufacturing. Right. What are some of the downsides that we'd have to deal with?
Right. Well, we don't know if we start using iron powder a lot. This is something that's actually in the nanotech sector as well. Like graphene. Graphene's one of the things I like. But if you start having nanoparticle size graphene, that could be the next asbestos in terms of if this actually is absorbed into the human body, if it's everywhere. What happens if we have iron powder in large quantities? Right? How do we manage that? What happens if we just have a pile of the stuff sitting in someone's backyard? Does it rust? Does it get into the water? Or what? It's an inert material that we know how to deal with, so it's a mature technology, right? But do we know how to use it at scale with this? We think we do, but we as a society, this is not a technical thing, we as a society have got to evolve to the point to use it appropriately, right? And so it's possible, for example, to have a device that would fit in your living room that can combust iron powder and produce 2,000 degrees centigrade in your living room, right? So before we had these, you had like a massive smelting plant, and you had people who were professional and had a lot of security. But what if the technology became so simple anyone could do it? And these things are simple. It's just a furnace. And it's the same material for iron powder that you would use in the powder coating industry. So the idea of having a Homer Simpson moment with a fat finger, or I press the red button instead of the green one, is that a problem? 2,000 degrees Celsius. So the capacity for an industrial accident is higher.
And then what? And then also like terrorism and, iron powder melting steel beams, in a skyscraper like that.
Well, hang on. So will iron powder as a fuel source will heat stuff, but it'll be like any smelter and it'll take time.
Okay.
Right. It takes time to melt stuff. It doesn't happen instantly. When someone flew two airplanes into three buildings and knocked them down, two airplanes into two buildings and knocked three buildings down. Something else happened there.
We'll have to have another episode to discuss that.
Loose change.
Actually, the one I like is...
Sure, we might have to have a few episodes, actually, based on this conversation.
I do actually like looking at this stuff. We have to, because that's the world changed at that point for a number of reasons. And I've actually come to the conclusion that once you get past of it's a conspiracy, it is the most interesting example of happened because something happened, and I liked Judy Wood's presentation when she actually pointed out a few things, and that it does actually imply a different kind of technology was in play, and it's energy-based technology, and so we've got to grow up and get past that it's a conspiracy and actually look at what happened. It's one of the most interesting case studies. Of course, if I was...
But I think a lot of people have looked at it, right? I mean, we've had a lot of structural engineers look at what happened, and they seem like, okay, it seems reasonable what happened based on these two planes hitting the towers. So,
I also work on the idea, too, that this is, again, not provable. It's an opinion. But many of the issues that we look at the moment is people will defend a point that's irrational. And they will do so based on emotional belief. And I think we've been subject to an unconventional form of social conditioning where some parts of our society will defend a certain point that's not about the facts, the demonstrable facts, and they will defend it to the death. And that's what I'm saying is it's really problematic. We can't agree on what those facts are. And that's one of the classic problems with that. And that's why I generally don't talk about that subject publicly, but I have an interest in it, but I certainly wouldn't sort of talk about it professionally.
Sure.
It's not geology, for example. But it is energy. And the energy required to do that is very interesting. And so I look at it in terms of yeah, Mungo want one of them. Can I have one of them? I'd like one of them. What could I do with one of them?
All right. So you've mentioned some of these unintended consequences. I guess, how confident are you in, you know, once this is scaled, like if we were to scale up, you know, your proposed solution,
I don't know how this will scale. Like, it looks very simple, right? Now, I actually went to a factory in Copenhagen called Copenhagen Atomics, and I looked at these guys making this, and they will be ready for commercial action in 2028. But then again, a lot of their planned tests that the government of Denmark that were going to allow them to do in Europe, they pushed back to 2035. Like I said, the incumbent...
Sorry, you're just talking about the thorium reactors?
This is the thorium reactor, yeah. I actually went to a company that's making them. And they kindly showed me around their factory, and they let me take one photo, which I use. They have the complexity of a three-bedroom kit home. Most of what's in them is steel with some exotic nickel alloys. The scaling problem, and they said that they're planning to make one reactor a day out of that single factory. And from what I saw, that won't be a problem. Right. The incumbent government, though, is throwing roadblocks in front of them. So this is actually not a technical problem. They could have been up and running 5 years ago. They've been doing it 10 years now. But the established government said, nah, that's not cool. You know, for politics. So we've got to get out of our own way. We are the problem. We are the solution.
Let me just get this straight, though. There aren't other scientists that are challenging the practicality of what you've proposed.
Oh, there are.
And not directly challenging you, but just in general the technology. And like, I'm just trying to understand what gives you so much more confidence in this.
All right.
Yeah.
So the confidence in the work I did on the oil industry was based on when I actually looked at how many times we went to war in a place where there was oil. So it actually makes sense for me to show you that. Now, I think I've already sent you a copy of this. So, okay, I'm going to share my screen again. Share screen.
This will be another episode titled Geopolitics with Simon Michaud.
So, all right. So let me just zoom in. Okay. So what we've got here is on the right, no, on the left, there is a, a military action happened. You know, things like, you know, the 1991 Gulf War, the 2003 Iraq War. So we've got 1979, in Iran, but we've also got who's been subject to economic sanctions? Where has war happened? And so the column on the left, Iran, Iraq, Kuwait, are now either under the direct control of the West, or they're places like Venezuela and Russia, who have now sort of broken out under, and they're in now what's called BRICS. Or I think Venezuela would like to be BRICS, but yeah, anyway. On the right, we've got who has been the people going to war, who have been in, you know, the aggressors, if you will. So the United States, Saudi Arabia, and then you've got the petrodollar agreement. Iraq was a United States ally until they were thrown under the bus in the 1991, I think, and they were selling arms. Canada, the European Union, and the United Kingdom. And they were all in one big strategic partnership. Now, the column on the left weren't really in a strategic partnership as such, you know, but they've become one through necessity. And what this is both sides have reserves, production, and consumption. But what this is about to me is who controls the oil industry as we approach peak oil? And 2018, it all stopped. And I think the war in Syria was the last time we saw a war. The war in Syria was about two gas pipelines, one backed by Russia, one backed by the United States, to feed Europe. And so that's now in progress. The reason this gives me confidence in what I'm seeing here is you look at what people do, not what they say. If they're going to go to war on this, and the reasons behind the war have been, you know, not what, if you do a bit of digging, what's really sort of going on. Oil was important. Oil was very important. But then it all just suddenly stopped and we've moved on to something else now. So what I've sort of seen, the idea of like in November 2018, we saw a peak in crude oil production. Crude oil. Yes, biofuels have come online, and yes, natural gas liquids have come online from the gas industry. So what we put in the car, in terms of total liquids, that is still creeping up and will continue to do so. But oil as such, the date of peak oil of November 2018 thus far, was what's now 7 years ago or 6 years ago, holds. And while that's happening, all the other reservoirs, 80% of reservoirs are depleting. We're not really finding new stuff. So the confidence in the oil industry is about to become unreliable, I'm comfortable with that. The confidence in the green transition stuff, I suggest what I do is I show my sensitivity analysis. Okay, so let me just, this is what I shared you before. Share. Okay. Come on. All right, boom. Can you see that?
Yes.
Okay, so I took the base calculation, I did a straight calculation, assuming a 28-day buffer. And while it sounded like a lot, that's turned out to be relatively, the real buffer is probably between, say, 20 days, maybe 20 to 25 days. If we actually accept curtail in demand where society doesn't need power all of the time, that can be cut down to 1 or 2 days. But because we demand power all the time, yeah. So what I did here was if I took each one of these parameters and I changed it. So what if the electric vehicle fleet was reduced by 50% or 90%, like the number of cars on the road? Or if the electric vehicles were increased by 200%? If trucks were electric vehicles. So we've got like a certain amount of power and a certain amount of minerals that are needed. So I'm going to go through all of these. If we reduce the truck fleet by 50% or increased it by 200%, what would happen? Well, the big one was if the maritime shipping industry was reduced by 90%. Steel production was a big one. So if we reduced our steel production by 50% or we increased it by 300%, remember, we're about to retool everything. The black down the bottom here is conventional electricity that we use for electricity at the moment. If we sort of cut demand by 50% or it increased by 300%, like what the IEA predicts between now and 2050. I can give you the IEA study, by the way. We never actually got around to that.
Let's see that graph for these sensitivity scenarios play out.
Okay, so then you've got the alpha to mu. So what if solar panels increased their operating hours by 200%? Like they became 200% more efficient, or if wind became 200% more efficient, or if the entire energy mix was 50-50 and so on. And so, all right, let's look at that. So the baseline is the baseline calculation of 48. This is the amount of power we need, 48,939 terawatt hours for a year. So if we reduce the transport fleet by 50%, it only dropped a bit. 90% is still, relatively small. If we increased it by 200%, twice the amount of cars, well, it does go up a bit. I think it's around like 10-12% increase. Relatively small compared to what's coming. Right. If we had three times as many buses on the ground, but they're all electric vehicles, what would it look like? What if we reduce trucks? Again, we're bouncing around. It's relatively small. Rail, if we increase by 3 times, this is power consumption. With rail, you've got to spend money on the infrastructure. But once done, it's actually pretty cheap. So maritime shipping, if we reduced it by 50%, 90%, we're still within a range of, you know, like plus or minus 10%, which in the scheme of things doesn't make the amount of effort we would have to do through that. So what's really controlling this? So steel production was, if we increased it by 200% at the moment with current rates. And the big one is, so if we did it up to 300%, like everything had to be removed, yes, okay, now we're up at around 30%. And ammonia, if you're for fuel. And then if we took our existing conventional electrical power and changed it, and if we increased it by 300%. So this is actually the amount of power that we're using at the moment. If we could somehow change it, that had the biggest thing, followed by steel production. And if we're not allowed to use fossil fuels in that steel production, how do we do it? Okay, now, so the amount of metal. So you get the baseline. So if solar panels increase their operating hours by 200%, we get a very, very small reduction in the amount of metals. And the same for wind turbines. So if they became twice as effective, it may bugger all difference. If we wiped out all other energy systems and it all came from wind and solar only, then we had a big increase. The big one here is nuclear. So this is conventional nuclear. If the energy mix was altered to nuclear power to increase to 30% of the energy mix, that's the biggest decrease. If 80% of the batteries became LFP, the LFP chemistry, that's the change. And if 80% became solid-state batteries. And the hybrid scenarios, if we were to degrow by a percentage, this is the if we were to shrink to, I think, 50% of the size. Anyway, so that is the sensitivity analysis. Stop sharing. So what I'm basically saying there is, am I confident in my work about the green transition? And so it's a very simplistic calculation. It was to look at a very, very fundamental idea that we should look at the raw materials that we need to make stuff if we're going to replace the entire system. Like, we're so used to thinking of maintenance, like a tiny fraction each and other. So that basic thing there screams to me. It's no one's really looked at it. And yes, more sophisticated work can be done. And if someone did more sophisticated work, the numbers could go up or down, because I haven't included everything, but new technology could make a difference.
The big thing, Simon, that sticks out to me is the analysis seems like relatively linear, but we know we live in reality. Reality is a nonlinear system. It's a highly complex system. And so you would have various feedback loops that would really affect those calculations
very much
in a very significant way. But you've been very clear about what you're doing, and it's kind of a snapshot, and it is a more basic kind of estimation. And But yeah, a lot of people aren't. No one else is really doing it to that extent. As you've talked about, there's all these other constraints, you know, in terms of the time it takes to set up these the mines and the power plants and so on. So I think you have a pretty interesting argument.
So when I talked to government officials who went and checked this was what we were talking about before. I often heard, we check some things. We checked some of your assumptions and they were found to be true. But we did not repeat your calculations, because no one's that stupid to spend that much time. It's a 1,000-page report. It's 580 tables of Excel data. They said, look, we can't justify that. So they don't understand how I was able to do it. But what they basically said is, they looked at the assumptions, and if those assumptions are basically correct, but they're not part of conventional thinking, they went away and thought about it. Toyota contacted me in late 2021. They had the same conversation, and I said, go away and check a few things, and they did. They didn't get back to me, but I have noticed that Toyota has discontinued electric vehicle production, and now they put their hat on hydrogen vehicles and ammonia vehicles.
That could also be because of, you know, the feasibility of their electric vehicles, their competitive posture vis-a-vis other countries.
Both, all of the above.
Or it's directly related to what Simon said. I mean,
it's due process. While they're competitive, they check stuff out. They check lots of stuff out. They ring me up. Can you send us your data? Okay, here it is. Didn't hear from them again. But part of the process, is this going to work? Now, the commercial world at large has decided that, renewable technology in the UK, for example, when they brought it on years ago, they said, look, it's not very developed at the moment, and we're going to subsidize this stuff, but it's developing technology. A quarter of a century later, they are still paying those subsidies, and they're still having trouble being economically viable. And this is the problem. So before we even get to my analysis of quantities of metals, the effectiveness and flexibility of these systems and the viability of these systems is proving to be problematic, right? And so collectively, the commercial world is going, let's do something else. But it's really only academia and public government groups that are shouting from the rooftops, we're going to do this, we're going to do this. So back to what I was talking to before about the Department of Energy in the States. They contacted before I get to them, the German Civil Service contacted me, and this was in 2022. This was when the monkey business in Ukraine started up and the Russians turned off the gas as a consequence of the chain reaction that happened. The German Civil Service rang me up and he said, look, all of our models for the future have crashed. But we're in a place now we never thought. And look, there's a very bitter internal debate about what we should go going forward. Should they go back to fossil fuels? Should they open their coal mines again? Should they start nuclear again? Should they force renewables to work in some way, if they can, if so, how? And they said there was a very bitter debate about what paradigm should carry them forward. And they said, and I never heard what happened, but it sounded ugly. What ended up happening in Germany was a point of paralysis, and I think some communities started cutting down local wood chip, made a lot of wood chips so they can heat to get through winter. In the end, it worked out okay and everything like that. I still don't know what the Germans are planning to do. My plan is to get my purple transition into their hands so they can actually look at it. And if it worked, they wouldn't have to talk to the Russians again or the Americans. And so this.
Well, we're glad to help get the word out, Simon. So yeah. We do need to wrap this up, though.
All right.
We really appreciate you coming on. How can people reach you if they want to find more of your work or contact you?
Or if some government agency wants to track you down.
They find me. They've got no problems finding me. I'm actually, I get invited a lot to conferences to speak and to talk. And when I talk to these people in private, they're very supportive of my work. But publicly, they're a bit more reluctant to mention it out loud. That's slowly changing. And I'm moving on to other frontiers now. I'm moving into the thorium space now, and there's other frontiers after that. Okay, where I can be found? Well, I've got a personal website. And let's make sure I get the right one. No, SimonMichaud.com. Hang on.
We'll put it in the show notes too.
Hang on. So I'm just going to put. Last time I did this, I put a spelling mistake in my own website. Okay, here it is. SimonMichaud.com. So I'm going to. Is there actually a show notes thing?
Yeah. We'll include it in the show notes. You don't even have to spell it out here.
But okay, so
I've got a website. It needs updating, but I'm trying to put all my work up on that. What I would say is my work's not perfect. I'm just one guy, but I've uncovered a series of blind spots. I do try to meet my critics. The last set of critics I met were they're arrogant as hell. They're really arrogant. But it turns out the solution they were putting forward was theoretical as well. Right. And so instead of trying to destroy my work, make new pieces of work that answer the same questions that make it obsolete. From a bottom-up point of view, if we're going to maintain the number of cars, the number of physical activities, but we're going to do it with non-fossil fuel systems, and you've got a technology that you think you can do it, right, do it and use the same methodology and then see what the final outcome is. Then we can talk. So
Yeah, that makes sense. Well, again, you've been very generous with your time, so very much appreciate it, Simon.
Okay.
And we'll have maybe more conversations down the line with some of these interesting points that we've hit in this episode. So.
There's no shortage of them. We're in a world where, on a day-to-day basis, the world is interesting. And people want to know. So, yeah.